When the girls get together, guys are lining up across the country, you know, to help John. Right? You have no idea. Well, when the guys are away, the gloves come off. I could listen to Amanda Magnolia read the phone book. I could talk about spirit, just in light. And April, thank you. Where'd you go? There you are. Thank you so much. Whoa, boy. I don't know what I'm going to say today. And I used to think that it was a little bit pretentious when people stood up and said that, you know, oh, I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say. But but as I stay around more, I realize, you know, that that I really don't. We talk about living authentic lives. The word is honest. It's authentic sounds so much more hip, but it's really about honesty. And I think they're synonymous. But I didn't tell you this yet. My name's Carla Rallin. I'm an alcoholic. I'm so delighted to be here. Polly, thank you. And thank the committee. Thank whoever had to sign off on my being here. And I've been here before. And something happens here. Something happens here. There's big love in these rooms. And if you're new or if you've been around a while, you know, I hope you just get to open up and feel it. You know, we're not. And if you're new, I guess I'm talking to the newcomer now. If you're new and we're here, there's a spirit that happens. You know, there's something that happens. We get our cups filled. Then we go home and it's time to do the work. This is inspiration here, and then we get to go do the work. You know, this is not the work. This is the inspiration, I guess. And so I hope that you'll take it and maximize the energy, because this is something that you really shouldn't miss. My sobriety date is September 25th, 1987. You know, for me, Alcoholics Anonymous was pulled the thread that unraveled the curtain that stood between me and the sunlight of the Spirit. That's what it did. I've always believed in God. I've always known that there was a power greater than myself, some power that runs in and around and through us. I've had spiritual awakenings. Getting a spiritual awakening, Mildred said it so perfectly last night, getting a spiritual awakening, having a spiritual awakening is only the beginning. It's only a start. It's a window. And then there's more work to do. We got to keep walking and opening up to that. I never could. I never could stay. You know, some challenge would come down in my life, and I would pull the curtain down. And after a while, I decided I was on my own. You know, there might be a God, but I don't think He has much interest in helping me. I can't get that, whatever that rhythm is between that God. And I loved Him, and I didn't stop looking, but I just couldn't stay. And today I'm supposed to talk about the fourth and fifth steps, which are... sometimes we get a little bit technical, but it's a real way of putting that desire into action. It's a demonstration of the third step. It's the first demonstration of having taken the third step. When I say I'm going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him, then the next thing is to take an action. And our book says that decision to take that third step can have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves, that are blocking us, not the things my mother did, or which it took me a long time to work that one out, you know, not the things she did, it was the things I bought, the way I reacted to all that stuff. And it took me a long time, still taking me a long time. My mother's been dead for 6 years now. And for some reason, I've learned more about my mother in the last 6 years than I was able or willing to learn while she was alive. And I don't know exactly why that is. I have some theories, but they're just theories and feelings. And anyway, I want to finish with the thank yous. And thank you, John and Jim. Gary and Chip for taping, and I guess Chip won out this year. And good to have a little clout in Atlanta. I can't talk about the fourth step without letting you know that I belong here. Everybody, and sometimes we're just, it's just semantics too. So it's just that. Sometimes it's semantics. Sometimes, and maybe that's just it. Maybe forever and ever we're all going to be sitting around the coffee table talking about our experiences with this and how we see them. We're going to have experiences and how we see them. And I believe that I'm an alcoholic, but I don't believe that it was the feelings that made me alcoholic. I had lots of great times when I was a kid. I had a lot of dark times. I felt dark and alone when I was very young because there were very dark times going on in our house, so it was circumstantial. And there was reason to feel that way. There were things that happened in my life where I was exposed to sex at an early age, and so there were a lot of sexual connotations to the way that I saw it, the sexual perspectives that I had. I mean, for a long time, even well into sobriety, everything sounded like sexual innuendo, you know. And to put it in my friend's words, she said that it took me a while to realize that when a couple invited me over to their house, it wasn't for a three-way. And you know, now it's funny, but it wasn't funny then. It was scary. It was all I heard, and I didn't know how to say this. Four-step process is putting this stuff on paper was a way of starting to be able to look at, it was a map to my responsibility in my own life. It's a map to my own responsibility. I'm not always responsible for the things that happen. I come from one of those dark households. Dark things happened. But what I did with it was darker. A lot of people come from criminal minds kind of households, you know, and they never became alcoholic and they never reacted. There's a thing going around on Facebook now. A kid just graduated valedictorian of his school. He's homeless, you know. And I was thinking about perspective, too. You know, Jane was traveling Europe with a backpack, you know, and it was like that was her good time. And I was like, living on the on-ramps of the 101 freeway in California and feeling very, very sorry for myself. You know, once in a while I would think I'm on a spiritual quest. But all in the perspective, isn't it? The thing about alcoholism with me, and with everybody, circumstances aside, is that at some point, all of us came to that torturous point of alcoholism where we're either drinking or thinking about drinking. Drinking or thinking about drinking over good times. We forget the good times. I've got a friend right now who just lost 12 years and she spent 17 months trying to get back. She can't get 3 days. She can't get 3 days of traction back into Alcoholics Anonymous. And she knows. She knows how good it can be. That girl was active. She was active, and not in just Alcoholics Anonymous, but in her family and in her community. So alcoholism can happen when we're, you know, when things are going well, too. It's still about drinking in that sense for me. Those are the stakes for alcoholics. Those are the stakes for me. Everybody has ego. Everybody has spirit. Everybody in the world has that. If we're all God's kids, it wasn't just alcoholics that got spirit and ego. It's all of us, right? But the stakes for me, not taking stock, which is a lot of non-alcoholics call that. There's spiritual exercises that religious and spiritual people do. I really have a little bugaboo about that too. If you're religious, it doesn't mean you're not spiritual. You know, are you religious? Are you spiritual? And me included, I used to do that too. You know, when I got here, I had such resentment to organized religion, and then realized, you know, just like in Alcoholics Anonymous, oh, that could never happen here, you know, where our egos get so big that we have to create, you know, some kind of dogmatic deal going on. See, that's what happens when I use my opinion. I get lost. So religious people, and I'm back. So religious people, they call it taking stock, you know, or just people, they call it taking stock of their lives, right? Well, I want to see where I'm at. How did I get here? What do I need to do to take corrective action? And we call it inventory. We call it the fourth step. We call it the tenth step. Same thing in the tenth step as the fourth step. Just to let you know, just in case you're wondering. Spoiler alert, if you're new. But so we're still talking about self. Everything that I drank and took, alcohol did something for me that nothing else could, it seemed like. You know, God got close, but it seemed like God took longer and didn't always show up when I needed him to. And incidentally, today, again, and it was said so well by Jane and Mildred, that God doesn't show up anymore. I wake up to what already is. And that's different. And that's my, I'm responsible for that too then. So in just a little technical stuff, the fourth step starts, the discussion of the fourth step starts on page 63. Next, we launch next. When do we do the fourth step? Next. Next. Personal house cleaning. And so talking about self, again, yeah, first, alcohol gave me the illusion that I was setting self aside. First, it kind of relieved me of the bondage of self for a long time, and then it threw me away, and I had to find something else. But for a while, alcohol, I took a lot of, when I got the hang of taking LSD, at first it didn't go so well. But you got to hang in there. I was introduced to what I thought was a realm of the spirit. You know, it seemed like it brought me to a place. So, you know, I wanted more of that. We were trying to conjure up. It was in a phase, you know, I mean, I tried a lot of different ways to establish and maintain that conscious contact with that power. You know, I was born into a Southern Baptist home. That religion worked very well for my mom for a long time, but I got caught up in the prejudices, you know, the hypocrites. I saw more about the people and the things they weren't doing and the way they weren't acting or the way they, you know, that doesn't happen here. and then I tried being a Catholic for a couple of weeks in the fourth grade. Because I liked all the ceremony. I liked the rosary. I saw pictures of little girls in white dresses, and it just seemed like something I might want to do. But I'm about as deep as a mud puddle, you know, if it doesn't work right away, you know. And then I burned black candles for a couple of years and prayed to the other guy for a while, you know. Just really trying to hedge my bets, you know. I just wanted to be on the side that was winning, you know. I didn't know, but I'm a seeker. Then the television series Kung Fu came out. Some of you guys remember him. Yeah. David Carradine, walking the Wild West in bare feet. That little bag of something on his belt. I don't know what was in that bag. It was tea. Beth says it was tea. He always looked pretty peaceful, though. Maybe it was probably chamomile. I thought there was such power in his few words. You know, he seemed so connected to something. And that attracted, yeah, again, I don't know, chamomile. But then I started drinking with a purpose when I was about 11. I mean, it just started to do for me something that I needed it to do. And it buffered me from you. It connected me to you. It was my image. It was my maturity. It was smoothed the edges off my life. It did it all for me. It made it preserved illusions that I was that I had. It felt like it was saving my life. And you know, home was really, really not a safe place to be. And for so long, I resented my mom for that. Oh my God! If nothing else, if you hear me say nothing else, this fourth step brings about the capacity or the potential for compassion. You know, I had it. It brings me to compassion, which brings around forgiveness, which brings me to being willing and able to take corrective action in the steps that we're going to talk about later. But first, I've got to see it. And it was said over and over, too, already that that I can come and I can behave well. You know, I can come in here and I can do all the right stuff. I can be, you know, I can be the committee chair. I can come out and be in my home group all the time and setting up chairs and making the coffee and looking real good. But mine is the head I go home with. Mine's the head I go home with, and at 3 a.m. I better have some kind of tool, something that starts to clear out the self that stands between me and the sunlight of the Spirit. Resentment, fear. And sometimes I think that steps 6 and 7 should have been written before 4. You know, because by the time we get to 7, and in the big book, I don't think he knew, or I think he would have written it down. But in 6 and 7, there are 2 paragraphs in the big book, and later on, the 13 pages in the 12 and 12, 13 pages. And I'm not with that school of thought that, oh, well, he was depressed when he was writing the 12 and 12. You know, I'm thinking, oh my God, and he wasn't when he was 3, writing the big book. A little perspective here. But fear being at the base, fear of not getting my way. We just talked about that in the third step. You know, all of the gyrations I go through to try to get my way. It's got to be my way. And it's only got to be my way because I'm afraid that if it's not my way, that something's going to happen. And I don't always even know what that's going to happen. Because sometimes, and I've discovered that, because if you give me my way, that's not right either. Do you ever feel like that? Like, you know, you no, I don't know what I want, but I know what I don't, and that's not it. And to start to open up and see, you know, I did the fourth step all kinds of ways. In the very beginning, I wrote that autobiography, and then it was brought to my attention that okay, that's a nice start, but then... that there are action questions. There are questions right from the very beginning. And it tells us what to do. First, we made a list. We listed people, institutions, and principles with whom we were angry. Man, I thought this is going to be fun. I had an idea that once my sponsor heard my fourth step, that she was going to go... No wonder you drank. I would have drank too. And she didn't say that. And then we asked ourselves why we're angry. That goes in that second column if you're doing columns. My first time through, I just answered the questions, you know, and I did it in rows. But I don't think that was wrong because something still happened. I still got to my part. I still got to my responsibility in my own life, and I still found the forgiveness. Not all the way. My mother took a long time. I did a lot of inventories on my mom, and even still was so angry. So it seemed like beyond my power, angry with her, that I would surprise myself. I blamed her for the stepfather that she married, and how, God, he was so mean. He was just so mean. I didn't know he was being mean to her. I thought she was just setting him up to be mean to us. And, you know, dragging us down the hallway by our hair, and just, he would just go off. He was volatile. He was a truck driver, and he'd go off on runs and all bennied up, you know, and then he'd come home and he'd be loaded for bear, tired and loaded for bear, and she just seemed like she lit the match and he'd explode. And I blamed her for that for a long time, and I had no idea till I got older and in Alcoholics Anonymous and starting to try to take a look at some kind of way to be able to let this go, that he was doing that to her too, you know, a long time in. So when I tell my sponsees that we're going to do this, I tell them the fun parts are the first two columns, you know, what they did, who they were, and what they did. Because then we're going to get to the petty parts. Oh, my God, what it affects. And when you start laying that out, oh, my God, have you ever seen how petty you are? What it affects, my pride. What I think of myself, how I think others should see me, how I think others should see me, or how I think they do see me, self-esteem, how I see myself, or what I want to see. And it's not, you know, I don't let them just say, oh, what it affected, check. Oh, self-esteem, check. What does that mean? You can't see anything in that. My ambition, what I want, what I want that I didn't get. Pocketbook, material. Oh, I know what I started to say too. Well, let me finish a thought. Pocketbook, material stuff I don't want to lose or I'm afraid I won't get. Security, emotional or physical security, approval, or a little attagirl now and then, or physical security. Just, you know, if I say something, if I have a question, then I'm not going to get smacked. Then I'm not going to have to walk around in fear all the time, in physical fear of physical harm all the time. Personal relations. How I relate to other people. I start to, you know, they have that old saying, you know, if you love something, set it free. And I was like, if you love something, push it off a cliff. And let's see if you come back from there, mofo. Sex relations, not just my sexual relations, but how I see men, how I see women. I saw my dad as someone who, he was always, I could always hear the quiet stomping of his, not stomping, but the quiet click of his heels when he'd come home. When I was a little kid, I would be laying in bed. My mom was so angry with him for never coming home. You know, he was working. His idea was, I'm working, I'm going to school, and then I play a little baseball. You know, but he was never home, not home. And they got married very, very young. My mom was always angry about that. And then they'd fight. And it seemed like she was the one crying and he was the one that was cool. You know, and I wanted to be cool like that because it seemed like he was unaffected, which was a little kid's head making up her own mind about something that just wasn't true. You know, he was very affected. I mean, now, all these years later, we're close, and I'm hearing a whole different side of all of that. You know, he was baffled. He was baffled. And so was she at their relationship. So, but I have this idea about men that I carry in, that, you know, and so I treat men like tree stumps a lot of times. You know, was that a slow roller, was it? I got my first social resentment behind a game of spin the bottle, and I know. And they don't even play that game these days. They just get right down to business. But by the time I got to sixth grade, seventh grade, I had a step-grandfather who had been molesting me, and a lot of babysitters who had boyfriends, and different things happened. And I know a lot of you know this. I know a lot of you have experienced this stuff. And so my ideas, and it was a sexual revolution. You know, so I didn't know what the good things were and the bad. I knew when it felt creepy, you know, but I knew that there was some kind of interesting stuff going on there too. So I'll take, but I didn't know how to own it back then, you know. And so I go into junior high into junior high is that summer before seventh grade, and I'm at my friend Leonard's house, and we're passing around a bottle of his dad's whiskey, and we're spinning the bottle. And the bottle we were spinning landed on me, and I went off into the bedroom with one of the boys, and we were both doing the same thing as far as I could tell. When we came back out of that bedroom, they called him a player and me a slut. And I did not think that was fair. And I still don't think it's fair if you want to know the truth. But every sponsor I've ever had has told me the fair comes around once a year and it lasts 2 weeks. That's all you get for fair. So. So when this talk is over, go home and ask your sponsor how to do a fourth step, okay? Because I know this is a little scattered, but you know, these ideas that I formed, I didn't know how to own who I was, and this fourth step began to show me who I am and who I'm not, and it still does. I still do inventory, and I call it a tenth step, you know, but I'm still doing the same process. You know, it's very funny. Because we talk about, you know, what the requirements are. You know, there are no musts, or these are just suggestions, or whatever. There's one requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is a desire to stop drinking. You know, someone who suffers from alcoholism and wants help to come in. But on page 25, it says that this process requires self-searching, leveling of our pride, confession of our defects. The process requires, and this is the process of finding out who I am and who I am not. And my morals may not be the same as yours, you know, but if they're hurting somebody, then I got to take a look at that. So I get to find out where my petty jealousies are, where my, you know, what other people think. Oh, you didn't think enough of me. Oh, I'm offended, you know, and you know, sometimes jealous, just so fearful that I'm not going to get something that you have, or fearful that I'll never have a good life, or fearful that I'll never, it's just, he talks about in step seven that fear is the chief activator of all our defects of character. And I never ever got it when someone said that they knew exactly what their defects of character were and now they're going to be removed. Because I am 28 years later, my defects of character, they come out in different forms. I mean, they're just fear at the base of it, and jealousy comes out maybe a little bit more subtle. Maybe it's just a little feeling, but I've got it in me. You know, maybe I know how to behave by now. You know, but it's very, very subtle. If it happens in me, then I gotta do something about that. I don't like this. Sometimes it's just a matter of, with meditation, just watching it and going, whoa. That's interesting. You know, sometimes I found myself acting in ways I don't even believe in, but yep, there I am. And then asking at the end of all of this, well, where have I been selfish? Where have I been withholding? Where have I been self-seeking? Not people-pleasing. Where have I been self-seeking? And where have I been dishonest? Not inauthentic, but dishonest. And where have I been afraid, frightened? And then I asked the ladies that I sponsor. Now, I started doing this a few years ago because in my life I saw that it worked, is that at the end of the resentment inventory, just pack, where have I been frightened, take that sucker and just do the fear inventory right at the tail of it. You know, and, you know, so I found the corrective action to take in the fourth column. But then I do that fear inventory, and then I've got an idea at the end when I ask God, what would you have me be instead of fearful here? What could I have done instead in the past, and what can I do in the future? I can meditate on that and have a new idea. Because what are we inventorying? My old ideas. Even if they were good ideas at one time, they're not working anymore. And that's the moral of it, is are they working? No, Dr. Phil, how's that working for you? Well, it is. Does it work? You know, that's the best convincer, to ask the person who's sitting in front of me, how's that working? So after a while, school wasn't working for me anymore. I really started to use alcohol with a purpose. It was a thing that I felt like was bringing me closer to God, and it was a thing that was really blocking me. And I took all those other things. I took a lot of acid. I'm just going to put in a little plug for singleness of purpose here too, right now. It's not an apology. There's nothing in the tradition that says we're not allowed to mention drugs. What they're asking us to is to please mention your alcoholism. How about that? How about let's talk about alcoholism in an AA meeting? That's I just asking if we can do that. I want to know. I really want to know, because if you apologize, then you're telling me that you don't care. That you know that this is going to happen, but you're going to do it anyway. So it's not the mere mention of drugs. Well, a lot of us did it in addition to our alcohol intake. But let's talk about alcoholism, because there is a big epidemic, and I don't know about you out here. I don't know what it's like out here, but I know in California we have a huge heroin epidemic. Huge. It's deadly, and people are dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because they're being told just to come in and say you're alcoholic. Just say you're alcoholic. Just say. And they're dying in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because they can't talk about what happened to them. And so, instead of shooting them out of the rooms, I had to inventory this. What am I? What is it? How do I do this? How do I face something? How do I face this and talk about it without? How do I do that? And so what we've come to is that we have to help them. You know, there are, Bill called it a special purpose group. We can get together a bunch of alcoholics who have been through the steps and take a drug addict through the steps so that they can go be a Bill Wilson in NA. You know, CA is flourishing. They've got Meth Anonymous, but there are still, for us, it's just been a hard thing. And then what happens is they stand up and they can't even speak about it straight. And this is not a new thing. They've talked about this in the Language of the Heart. I love that book. And Bill talked about how that happened way back then. You know, they answered the same questions about drug addicts and alcoholics and what the difference is and what the distinction is. And actually, the best description of alcoholism that I still believe exists is on page 44 in the Big Book. We hope we have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. If when you honestly want to, find you cannot quit entirely, or if when drinking have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. Now, I said all that to say that for a long time, those things were the things that I thought they were bringing me closer to God. They were the things that blocking me from God. And then when I was separated from those things, then there was me. And me is enough. Me is myself, my little plans and designs, what I want, how I want, what I'm willing to do to get them. Do I have to talk real nice to you? Do I have to do what you want so that I'll get what I want? Or if that's not working, am I going to just bully my way through your life until I get what I want? Am I going to just argue with you till you just can't take it anymore? And then you acquiesce. or run away. And I've done that in sobriety too. You know, I mean, this is the beginning of self-awareness, not self-obsession. And by the way, when you get to step 8, don't run back and do another 4-step. Oh, I don't think I did that right. This can't be right. I've miscalculated somehow. Because these steps can turn into a huge form of self-obsession. I need to go write about myself again. I'm going to write about myself. I don't think I have that right. I want to follow the map to the end to my responsibility in my own life. Where have I been selfish? Where have I been self-seeking? Where have I been dishonest? Where have I been afraid? And then how did that fear cause harm? God, I was never going to be the mother that I had, and I became every bit that, and maybe more. Maybe more. When my baby was 4 years old, I had my baby in a little trailer up in a place called Wilderville, Oregon. We had midwives. They delivered, you know, to Tequila People's Clinic. They deliver. And we paid our bill by chopping wood and baking bread, and I thought I was back to the land, you know, and drinking moonshine and homemade wine because it was organic and much better for you. And and after all the help I had, see, after that, when I started leaving home, I really started taking LSD. At first, it was a party. I mean, when I was 14, I wound up learning how to turn tricks in San Francisco. We hitchhiked all the way up there. We got dropped off in the middle of North Beach, and a couple of guys approached us, offered us a way to make some money, and there we were. You know, and if you had asked me back then, I would have said it's the next indicated thing. Just the next indicated thing. And Dr. Silkworth had some terms for that. He said that after a while, we can't differentiate the true from the false. After a while, our alcoholic life seemed the only normal one. And so I'm just presenting the stakes here again. You know, for a non-alcoholic, they have to take stock. If they're going to live a successful life, they have to see what the good ideas are in their lives and shed the old ideas. But for me, and resentments, you know, it's not so good to carry a grudge. Some of them are better grudge carriers than others. You know, and they might even have a bad day, a bad few months. But if I'm going to carry a grudge, the stakes for me are that first drink. And I can't take that first drink. If I'm surrendered to my alcoholism, that's where it is still very much about alcohol. Because that's the one thing that I can't do. I can't do it if I'm feeling great, and I can't do it if I'm feeling bad. I will never be so spiritually fit. I can do these all day long. I will never be so spiritually fit that I can afford to take a drink of alcohol in any form at all. Not mouthwash form, not food form. I don't know who puts food in their alcohol anyway. But so in that sense, it is about alcohol. That's the one thing that I can't do. It's the thing I remember. See, I can go to church. I love all the, I'm an and girl now. You know, as far as the sunlight of the Spirit, I want to go see what it's like over there. What are they worshiping over there? How are they doing that? I went to a Buddhist temple one morning, and they were talking about defects of character. You know, and like, when we're kind of new, we're going, oh, they've been to AA. We are not self-centered at all, right? It cracks me up because I was one of these voices too. You know, we get here and we know God just can't stand us. Right? God just can't stand this. I don't like God. He doesn't like me. Blah, blah, blah. All that. And then, like, 3 or 4 months later, we are his favorites. Too bad those guys out there don't have what we have. Not only have they had what we have, we stole it from them. And they're allowed to own property. We're not even trusted with property these days. We still rent. I'm just saying, it take, you know, it was the fourth step was the beginning of connecting to the people around me, the beginning of being able to be a better daughter. I wasn't a great daughter for a long time. Be a better daughter, to be a better mother. You know, I walked off to go to work when my daughter was 4 years old, and I was on my way to work. Stopped at the bar on my way to the bar because I worked at a bar, but you have to stop before you. I had done this for months. Stopped at the same bar every afternoon on my way to work. Go to work, come back home, and this particular afternoon, I stopped at that same bar and had those same drinks, and I couldn't get off the bar stool. And I didn't hate the job I was going to, and I didn't love my daughter any less on that day than I love her today. But I couldn't stop drinking. So to begin to look at my responsibility, the kind of a daughter I was, you know, how did I respond to her? I really couldn't hit her. I didn't even realize it. After a while, after that time, and a year after the time in San Francisco, I ended up in a mental hospital. I was 15 years old, and I looked crazy. And like Mildred said last night, you know, there weren't a lot of treatment centers around. This was a mental hospital, and so there was a lot of crazy going on inside. Some of the real deal, real schizophrenia, real manic depression, the real thing. You know, it exists. And I was there amongst them, and I was getting medicated with the best of them, you know. Thorazine, Melaril, Valium, Dalmane sleepers. Oh, right before that, this, which was, I didn't think was so crazy till after I did it, but we had a pile of LSD, which is how this whole thing started. And we had like 23 hits left. No, we had 19 hits left. I had taken three, and then I knew I was going back to be locked up. And so I took the rest of it. And I know you... And you cannot be in a fearful. It was not very spiritual at all. The hotel was melting, and we were going to blow up. And glad to see my grandma, but I knew she was dead, so there's a little bit of a problem. Wound up in the emergency room, and then they shipped me right straight from the emergency room to the mental hospital, and validating the fact that I probably needed to be in the mental hospital for a little while. And I just got crazier. See, here, all along the way, people trying to help me. I could have been I swore that I was a victim all along. Stuff happened in our household. So there, some people grow out of that, you know, but me, I just took it, not because I'm an alcoholic, because of who I am, what I did. Self-pity goes a long way with me. It's just warm. It's just, you know, don't even notice, you know, like kind of laying in a mossy gutter how stinky it is, but it just, because it's just so warm. And I knew I didn't want to go home. And instead of just saying, I don't want to go home, and all of the responsibility or whatever it was, perceived responsibility I thought was going to happen over that, I just got sicker. I just acted worse and got sicker. And people that were trying to help me, all I had to do one time was to tell them the truth. Just say the truth one time, and I could have been helped. Instead, I saved all that stuff for later, and as... saved it for future reference. And just disintegrated before everybody's eyes. And alcohol kept the illusion preserved, kept the illusion alive, until I finally got here. And I didn't get here till almost 15 years later, almost 15 years after that. You know, because I tried everything, because it can't be the alcohol. Anyway, when I got here, what I loved about Alcoholics Anonymous is that I could start from where I was. I had all these weird ideas, and I heard you guys sitting in here sharing about these things, and it sounded like I could start from where I was. I didn't have to be any more than I was or know any more than I knew. I could just be. And I had all these weird ideas. I was a bewildered one, you know. I tried all those spiritual avenues, and I still knew that they worked, but I just couldn't hold on to them. Couldn't hold on to that awakening, because what's in the way? Me. My selfishness, my self-seeking, my dishonesty stem from my fear. I'm dishonest because I'm afraid. I'm self-seeking because I'm afraid. Selfish because I'm afraid. Oh, God. You know, and I didn't want to be afraid when I got here. I didn't want that to be the thing. It sounded a little wimpy, you know. We were talking about this earlier today. You know, someone who walks in going, I don't care what you think. Oh, really? It seemed like an awful lot of effort went into that one. So we get to talk about what they did, how it affected me, my favorite parts. And then we get to the bottom of page 66. It's a turning point. It's a turning point in this. This was our course. Oh, we turned back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. All about how we see it. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. Like, even when they did it to me, if they did it to me, I'm still... A lot of those people were long out of my life, and I'm still drinking, and I'm still mad. I might even be madder now, because now I've just really spun it up, you know. And... you know, those relationships with men. I was always getting around men who were... My stepfather, as mean as he was, he fell in love with me because I was a good athlete. You know, I ran track. I was a speed demon, and I played softball. I won Southern California... played in the Southern California Championship. Pitched, traded with shortstop. I mean... And he was out there all the time with me in the back. That was our way of connecting, you know. And so for a long time, I didn't get that, you know. It was like sometimes you pay a price to be around a guy you like, you know, to do those common things. And, you know, every once in a while you might get smacked, but, you know, that's the price you pay for being around a guy you like. And some of those things we don't see in ourselves, I didn't understand that was happening at the time. I was with a boyfriend who, after I got out of those places, I was with a boyfriend from another rehab, you know, like meets like. And, you know, if you're looking for a partner, that's where they keep them. And, and again, you know, Bill talked about us having moral and philosophical convictions galore. I want to be this. Peace and love. And, you know, the 60s were happening when I was 12. Or they were just coming, you know, I was 12 in 1969, so there was marching and songs and, you know, Joni Mitchell and Joan Baez and Bob Dylan. And the times were changing a little bit, but it was still there. I was in a girl's home, and we're talking to our friends about where are they? You know, San Francisco isn't so right anymore. Where are they? And they're like, they're in Oregon. Go to Oregon, where God might be. You know, there are people in Oregon. And, you know, and I don't know about you, but I never went anywhere thinking, let's go screw this up too, anywhere new, you know, thinking, let's go screw this up too. I was went somewhere thinking, let's, you know, but until I have some idea of what my makeup is, I got very little chance of it changing, you know. I have to follow it up. And so I get all this stuff down on paper. We're prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see the world. Oh, they dominate us. They're still running my life. They're running my life, these people. And they're nowhere to be found. We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. This was our course. So now we have a course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick, though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. We asked God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, "This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done." We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. And I'll even go one better now than that, because I do that with confidence, because it's just so weird. Have you ever had someone come up to you and make amends because they're being the bigger person? And they let you know. So I don't like that coming at me, so I'm not going to bring that to you, you know. The way that it was put to me is, and it happened when I was about 5 years sober. I had been raped by a guy who had used to be sober, and now he wasn't sober anymore. And he showed up in my bedroom one in the middle of the night, and I was like, "One more time." This was a big one. You know, I got to do this inventory on the day-to-day stuff, but this one was a turning point because I had to decide. You know, this was everything that I had ever been or worried or feared, maybe even more. Like, that stuff used to happen out on the street. Not that we deserve it, but it's a lot more likely to happen out there when I'm putting myself in that position. But I'm not doing that at 5 years of sobriety. I've been going to meetings. I've been going to work. I've been paying rent for more than a month in a row. You know, I've been showing up. And now what is this? What is this? Does this mean that maybe it's in my karma that once in a while stuff like this is going to happen because of who I was? You know, it was a real question as far as I was concerned. And the old timers said no. They said, some people are just not looking to do God's will yet. And you got in his way just like people got in yours. And see, that brings it home. See, because forgiveness is never going to happen from a spiritual hilltop. Never going to happen. It happens in me when I see that you are just like me. That the things that you do, I either have done, could do, or am doing right now. I have been just about everybody I've ever resented. Right? And so when I do that, it stops me. It stops me from even starting to entertain those thoughts or those feelings that I have about people. You know, some are harder than others. You know, some things come at you and it just takes me longer. But this is where I stay. You know, this is the process. It's the only process that's worked. And again, for me, I know what the stakes are. If I don't continue to do this, then it could be looking at that first drink. And I've just seen too much in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I was going to say about spirituality earlier, now is the time of finishing sentences, okay? So, I forgot. Listen, it's like 10 o'clock for you guys. It was 6 o'clock for me. So buckle up, buttercup. So I'm just going to start to talk about step 5, because I'll remember. When I want the kitchen cleaned, I go work in the backyard, and it works like that. So admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being. Like the passage that April read, you know, by the time we've written this down, we've swallowed a few, some big chunks of truth about ourselves. By the time I even get done writing, by the time I even just get it on the paper, I've begun to see. I've begun to open that up a little bit, if I'm even the least bit willing. I've begun to see that you know, I've got a responsibility in this. Now, sitting with my sponsor, I thought, like I said, I thought that first she was going to just go, "Oh, yeah, Well, no wonder you drank. But she, you know, she didn't. There were a lot of things that I had a good handle on, you know. I read it to her, and I felt connected to somebody, you know, and she didn't judge me. I needed to read all this stuff, and she didn't judge me. And she had some judgments, too. You know, she had some judgments that later I pretty much judged, you know. I thought, really? It's a good thing you didn't judge me, because... I always like to say, the only fifth step I like better than mine is yours. After the first time through the steps, and then I continue to take my personal inventory in 10 and 10, the best way that I know how to go through the steps is to take somebody else through them. And what starts to happen is I have a living visual sitting in front of me of ways that I felt and thought that I couldn't even have articulated when I was doing my own. And I see it in you and I go, oh, and the light comes on. You know, and this is where we are not separate. You know, this is where the real connection, we are one, where the real connection comes, and here's where the real responsibility is too. I can't like you and not, or I can't love you and not you. I can't be okay with you and not you. I don't get to say you're God's kid and you're not. Oh. Because sometimes I think there should be a little slot. But the best I can do is to say, you know, this one may take some time. I don't always know. I love what Polly used to. I wish I had known this before. I came about it in the long way around. But when Polly takes someone through, listens to someone's four steps, she says, "Before you tell me your story, tell me your mother's. Before you tell me your story, tell me your father's." The fourth step. That's what I was going to say. The fourth step is the beginning of the compassion, the beginning of real compassion. Real compassion. I cannot hold you up to something I can't live up to. And I have to, when I see you having foibles, I have to understand that I've got those too, and that's what I look like coming at you. And I may never be able to completely understand what somebody's going through at the time, but if I'm honest with myself and honest about myself, I can usually understand, even if I have to get out of the way for a little while. Even sometimes it just means get out of their way for a little while if they're not, you know, open to anything else. But I can recognize it, and I don't have to stay angry about it. I can just see that, man, this one's hard. This one's hard. It just is. And over time, I don't even know where this fits in, but I have stopped trying. I have been making an effort not to judge the way I feel, that I just feel. It just is. It just is. Not to have to change that that's the way it is, to notice. You know, I have a big prayer and meditation practice, and I notice. My connection with God is all over. And that's something I wanted to say, too, is that I love the authors and the teachers, the spiritual authors and teachers that say, you know, they'll say, this method worked really well for me, but as soon as you hear somebody say this is the only way, get the hell away. The hell away from them. You know, and I've gone through this. I'm just talking from my own experience. You know, I don't know about you, but I've gone through times. Maybe it doesn't happen in Atlanta, but where I've just tried to be so technical about all of this, to engineer spiritual awakening. And then I get tired of trying to do that for myself, so I go do it on my sponsees, and they don't like that very much either. Perfectionism doesn't mean we're perfect. It just means that we're now obsessed with the idea of being so, which makes us a lot of fun to be around. So whether you do it in columns or paragraphs or whatever, answer the questions. Find out where I've been selfish, self-seeking, dishonest, and afraid. And then when I start to share it with somebody, oh my God, stuff happens. You know, first of all, I learn that I can feel safe with some people. And even when things have been shared around town, when I know that people are talking about me, because I'll have a friend who'll call up and say, they've been talking about you. Which I'm not sure where that fits in. That sometimes that's just got to be, it's my exercise in being able to exist and grow whether you like me or not. Because I don't want to be who I think you need me to be. And that some real honesty has to come in there for me. You know, I don't want to play to your tune anymore. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew a couple of things. I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. I couldn't have told you it was because of an allergy or an obsession, but I knew I couldn't drink anymore, and I needed help with that. But I also knew certain things, like you couldn't use Carla in good character in the same sentence. You couldn't do that. I didn't know how to be stand up. I didn't know how to do that. And time after time after time, I've had opportunities in my sobriety, like that rape deal, you know, that it was for me to forgive the guy and testify against him at the same time. You know, that dichotomy of doing, being responsible and yet not hanging on to the grudge. You know, and letting myself be changed, letting it be used to help somebody else maybe. But in the meantime, doing what I need to do. And sometimes that's hard, because sometimes I read your mind and I think... sometimes the more I read your mind and the further I am away from you, the worse you are. Too, I, you know, get scared. I don't want to go. I don't want to go there. She's going to say that. He's going to say this. You know, this is my coming to terms with myself. You know, I didn't want to be afraid when I got here. You know, I'm tough. And I hung out with those guys sometimes just because I didn't know anybody. When I got out of the mental hospital, I was destroyed. I was disintegrating before my very eyes. At my own hand. A lot of that stuff was at my own hand. And I hung with people because I lived on the fringes, because I didn't know how to be in the marketplace. I didn't know how to be in the real world. I lived in the woods in a tent. I sleep by the side of the road and call it camping. We call it homeless down here, but okay. However you want to dress it up. And inside all of that was some sincerity. You know what I mean? I really... wanted to be that. I really want. I all those spiritual teachers I studied back then, I study now. I listen to Ram Dass. Be here now. When I heard Sharon talk on a tape when I was new, I thought there's somebody who was looking in the same place I was. And these steps have just been boiled down to their last, to the very simplest, most useful medium. You know, we just have to pick them up and use them. There's no judgment in them. We just pick them up and use them. You know, it's not a brand of a broom. It's just a broom. We didn't invent it, but Bill discovered a way that we could point spirituality right at alcoholism. And that's what I'm doing here. That's what I'm still doing in Alcoholics Anonymous, is talking about alcoholism, because I can go study all that stuff and I can go be with all those teachers and I can enjoy and grow and love what's happening in my life. But if I don't stand at the door of Alcoholics Anonymous and talk to the newcomer and see active alcoholism on their face, in their life, in their being, then I might forget. I might forget why I'm here. These stakes for me, the stakes for me and my human condition are a drink of alcohol, because I can't take the first one or it'll take the next one. And that's a fact. It scares me a little bit when we say, I know what we mean when we say it's not about alcohol anymore. There's more to quitting drinking than quitting drinking. There's a lot of work to do. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, what's happened is instead of not drinking, you gave me something else to do. You gave me a sufficient substitute that just expelled the obsession. And again, I want to say, too, that I was 9 months sober before that horrible obsession was lifted. In the middle of making my amends, I had to go through this process. And as inadequate as it might have been, when I look back, I think, oh, my God. You know, but the barest beginning, my best efforts, even though they may be inadequate, have always been enough to be able to propel me into the next. So I've not been backing away from a drink. You guys gave me something else to do. Alcoholics Anonymous has been a sufficient substitute. But I need to stand here. I need to stand at the door of Alcoholics Anonymous and welcome in the newcomer and give to them what was so freely given to me. Because all I can tell you is that whatever my life may have looked like, it's been sloppy at times in sobriety. It's been great. It's been brilliant. It's been really, really sad. Sometimes really dark. I'd take that walk again. I'll take that walk again because it's the best I've ever had. You know, and now it's wonder. And when I sit and I listen to somebody else's fifth step, I see the light come on in their eyes. You know, when I see in their eyes, I see redemption and lovability, and I see forgiveness and freedom, a little bit of freedom, enough to make a start. So again, we're not working the steps here right this minute, you know, but I hope that you'll find some reason, something anywhere in any of this weekend that will inspire you to go home and maybe on the way home and do what it takes to stay here. It's a good life. It's the best I've ever known, and thank you for that.